You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, our guest says President Trump's foreign policy actions could take the world back to the 1930s, with serious risks to the U.S. and beyond.
Right now, when you hear the word mummy, you probably think of Egypt and maybe the famous, most famous mummy in the world, King Tut. But cultures all over the world had their own systems of mummification, and a lot of the mummies are actually women.
Gemma Tarlak joins us now to talk about some of these mummies. They're dubbed Eternal Princesses in the latest issue of Discover magazine. She's a senior editor at Discover based in Waukesha, and she joins us once a month to share some cool science news. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So Eternal Princesses, who are these leading ladies?
Well, it's really fascinating because, you know, mummies are everywhere. We usually associate them, as you said, with Egypt and maybe a couple other spots. But really, they're found on almost every continent. And as you mentioned, a lot of them are women. So we looked at five of the most diverse of the mummy, lady mummies out there. And just to kind of introduce people to the different cultures and different time periods in which they lived. And, you know, we've got, for example, Lady Di. She was the wife of a provincial nobleman in the 2nd century BC in the Han Dynasty in southern China. And she was buried with, you know, the food she liked to eat, like her favorite meals and changes of clothing and all these really excesses from her luxurious life. And it was actually her luxurious life that led to her early death at the age of 50. She was a little too fond of rich things and sitting around in luxurious silks.
She had high cholesterol and a heart attack, apparently.
Yeah, they found that she had high cholesterol and diabetes and high blood pressure, and they think that, you know, just based on the condition of her internal organs, that she overindulged, you know, had a few too many swans. Swans were one of the foods found with her, and had a heart attack and died. And really, the interesting thing about her body is that they actually, the Chinese researchers who found her, were able to perform an autopsy on her because her skin is still pliable. Yeah, there's still blood in her veins. So it's a fascinating example of the different ways mummies are actually preserved.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, you know, mummies in ancient Egypt, they, you know, there's this huge ritual and process for doing it on purpose. As I understand it, some mummies just sort of happened by atmospheric conditions or whatever. Lady Di from the Han Dynasty here, was she mummified on purpose?
Oh, yes. In fact, from what we can see, not only in her body, but also in the way she was mummified, you know, she was wrapped in multiple layers of silk, and she was placed in four nested coffins, one, you know, inside the other. And they found traces of things like mercury in those coffins, which suggests that the toxic metal may have been used as an antibacterial. But, you know, basically, it wasn't really what was done to her to mummify her. She lasted this long in this great shape because those coffins created a hermetic environment. So, for example, you know, the Egyptian mummies, their procedures involved a lot of actual preservation of the organs intentionally, you know, basically soaking them in solutions of different chemicals, where that was a very different situation than Lady Di, who it was just the airless environment. It didn't allow any bacteria in to destroy the tissues.
Well, what about some other mummies around the world? Who are these other people who had been so well preserved?
Sure. Well, we've got the Siberian Ice Maiden, and she's a fascinating figure. She's more than 2,000 years old and from sort of the edge of Siberia and China. And she, you know, she had gorgeous tattoos on her body that have been preserved. And they think she was a young woman, probably about 30 at most. And it looks like she may have died from breast cancer, and that's based on MRIs. They're able to do, you know, an assortment of medical screening and scanning on these bodies, and they're finding things like abnormal tissue growth that they think may have been a malignant tumor. They could also tell that the Siberian Ice Maiden fell probably from her horse because she was part of a horse culture. She fell from her horse and injured her right hip and shoulder, and they think that she may have been kind of lingering on in pain for months before she finally passed, and that she may have actually been using cannabis to ease her pain. So they can find a lot of different things by looking at the tissues, scanning, doing chemical analysis on the hair, all the modern medical methods that we apply, they can apply these to these mummies that are thousands of years old.
That's amazing. So this is giving us a lot more information than just if we had a skull and some teeth or something like that, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. When you look at some of the others, for example, La Doncella of the Andes, they could tell that she was found more than 22,000 feet above sea level, and they can actually tell that before her death, her diet changed. It became much richer, and she also began to imbibe this special ritual beer, and they think that's because months before she actually died, she was chosen to become this very important sacrifice to the gods. And so once she was chosen, her diet changed, everything about her changed, because she was being prepared to become basically an intermediary between humans and gods. So tons of fascinating stuff they can find. And culturally, too, just what they're buried with, what they're dressed with. The mummies just, you know, our writer, Nate Sharping, had a great comment that these mummies really become ambassadors for their culture and for their time because they tell us so much that we can't get from just a skeleton.
And Gemma, before we move on from mummies, I was just in shock about self-mummification and just how Buddhist monks would go about this procedure of DIY, do-it-yourself mummification, and also the other forms of mummification that are more natural. Can you talk about those as well?
Sure, sure. Well, in addition to the hermetic environment that Lady Di was in, there's also just freezing, especially at high altitude, and that's what happened to La Doncella. There's also just desiccation, just being in an extremely dry desert environment. And also there are, you know, you may have heard of the bog bodies in Europe. Peat bogs are naturally anaerobic environments. There's no oxygen, so there's no reason really for bacteria to be there. So if the body is submerged in a peat bog, it can also be naturally mummified. But yeah, you mentioned the self-mummification, and that was practiced hundreds of years ago, mostly in Japan, by these Buddhist monks who for a decade would eat nothing but tree bark and pine needles, which have kind of natural desiccants in them to... It's hard to talk about, but basically like dry themselves from the inside out, and they would slowly starve. And, you know, if you want your mummy to last a long time, go on a diet before you die, because fat is one of the first tissues to break down and attract microorganisms. So if you're super skinny, you're already at an advantage to leave a mummy that's going to last a long time.
And so they would go on this decade-long extreme diet, and then at the end, they would bury themselves alive?
Yeah. It was this insane process where, well, I shouldn't say insane, but it was an intense process. Let's just say that they basically would bury them, get into this like wooden box that had a bell in it, and the other monks would listen for the bell every morning, and then if the bell didn't ring anymore, they would be like, okay, he's gone, and then just actually close things up and put the rocks on top of the coffin and such. So it was a very, very intense process. And there are a few surviving examples of these mummies, surviving in the sense that we still have the bodies. And they're in Japan and in a variety of places where sometimes people go and make pilgrimages even to the bodies. But they don't do that anymore, I should say.
On that cheery note, we're talking to Gemma Terlak from Discover Magazine. Well, let's perk things up, Gemma, and try to figure out how the universe is going to end. You know, the beginning,
yes.
Big Bang, expansion, whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. People are putting together theories on how, if it will end. What do we know?
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, it's not what we know, it's what we don't know, so we're trying to theorize. And we do know that the universe kicked off about 13.8 billion years ago. And they're looking at, we know that the universe continues to expand. And in fact, they're pretty sure that the rate of expansion is speeding up. What's going to happen? And so there are all these different theories. One of the main ones is called the Big Rip, and that is just that the universe keeps expanding until it basically pulls itself apart. Don't worry, though. That's not going to happen for about another 22 billion years. So we'll all be mummies at best of then. But then another theory is the Big Freeze. And that's the idea that, you know, the universe is expanding and it's not going to pull apart, but eventually things are going to become so far apart from each other that, for example, light from other galaxies, stars, won't reach our planet. Of course, our sun's going to go away before then, so you don't have to worry. But, you know, black holes will evaporate, matter itself will just decay into radiation, and the universe basically turns into a cold, lightless, lifeless place. This is just a really fun, upbeat segment, and I apologize for that. But yeah, so that's another theory. And then, of course, to me personally, the scariest theory is the false vacuum. And that's just that we think our universe is pretty stable. We think we've got a handle on the rate of expansion, et cetera. But what if I told you our universe is just this, like, tiny outpost within a larger multiverse?
Whoa.
And basically, yeah, oh, wait, it gets worse. So the researcher, one of the researchers involved in this theory, thinks that basically if you could imagine our universe as a bubble in a pot of boiling water, well, what happens to those bubbles in the boiling water? Eventually, they start colliding with each other. And there are some scientists to think that that could happen to our universe at any time. Our little bubble of a universe could just collide with another universe, and let me just say that would be a very, very bad day because we have no idea what would happen when they combine, but it won't be good.
Well, really, really quickly here, Gemma, do you think we'll know the answers to how the universe will end in our lifetimes? What's the timeline for figuring this out?
You know, that's a good question. Some of the theories that were advanced 10, 20 years ago, they've already been discounted as not possible. And the big key is learning more about dark energy. It's, you know, it's nearly 70% of our universe, and we know very little about it. We've never even documented that it exists for real. So if we can kind of pin dark energy down and figure out what its role is in the expansion of the universe, we have a much better chance of understanding how the universe is actually evolving.
I'll work on that after the show. Gemma, thanks a lot for joining us, as always.
Always a pleasure. Take care.
That was Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about some of the coolest science headlines.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a foreign policy expert who's worried about what he's seen so far from the Trump administration. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.